Hi everyone, my name's Jane and I'm an alcoholic. And I am so happy to be here, and I'm so happy that I got to meet Amy. And before I do anything, I just want to thank Amy for everything she did to make this convention the amazing convention that it was. Yeah! You know, her energy is amazing. Her light shines. I mean, she is pure sunshine in my book. So it's been one of the greatest gifts about this weekend is getting to know you, Amy. So thank you. And I remember when Amy called me and she said, hey, I'd really like to, invite you to speak at our 69th Georgia prepaid convention. And I was like, yeah, sounds like a party, And then, of course, when she said it was in Dublin, whoever picked the speakers this weekend, Ken, you got the Irish Catholic, trifecta. But, when I saw that symbol, it just really meant so much to me because my Irish blood, always loves shamrocks and four-leaf clovers. And that the poster kind of reminds me of that Irish blessing, until we meet again, may God hold you in the palm of his hand. So anyway, and yes, thank you too, Ken, for picking an amazing cast of speakers. So, yes. And the entire committee. It's Sunday. Let's show them all the love. Yeah, thank you, everyone. So, yes, my name's Jane, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September 24th of 1996. Woo! And thanks to this amazing program, my faith and my family, I am living the best life that I could possibly live. And since it's Sunday morning, I thought maybe we could all start out with a prayer. How about the third step prayer? God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, so that victory over them may bear witness to those I might help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will. So I always like to share that my drinking run lasted for 14 long years. And I'm so grateful for this non-religious, spiritual path that we're all on together. I always get choked up when I look out at this audience, because I think, probably every single person in every single seat should be dead. What a miracle that we're here to celebrate life. I really am getting choked up. And by the way, I'm not talking about just the AAs. I'm talking about the Al-Anons too. With everything that we put you through, yeah, you should be dead too. But anyway, I also just want to, thank all the other speakers and everybody who was here this weekend. But most of all, I want to thank you all because you're the ones that taught me how to live this life, that taught me how to live truthfully and honestly and lovingly. So thank you all for being here. These things wouldn't take off if it weren't for people like you showing up. And these conventions, you really feel the magic of God, don't you? Oh my gosh. So just a little, I just wanted to share a little bit about my week. I actually had the honor of visiting my older brother who just retired to a beautiful area called Sun Valley, Idaho. Oh my gosh. And I was able to see all of God's glory in, the beautiful scenery, the foliage. I feel like, no amount of prayer could have better prepared me to give my talk this morning than just the nature and God's handiwork that I was able to be in the midst of this week. And it was so funny because God works in mysterious ways. When I got asked to speak, I was supposed to speak on Friday afternoon, and sure enough, while I was in Idaho, I took a bite out of a hard piece of bread. One of those pieces of hard bread with you know, pesto on it or something, and I completely cracked my front tooth. So, and I got home at midnight on Thursday. So 8 o'clock in the morning on Friday, I was in the dentist chair. But you should have seen it. I mean, and I look around and I see all these speakers. It would have been terrible. As a matter of fact, my brother was joking with everyone he introduced me to. He's like, this is my sister Jane from Tallahassee, Florida. You know, I had one tooth. So anyway, it worked out great because, you know, I got my tooth fixed and, you know, I was able to give my talk with a full front tooth. So I'm very happy about that. But anyway, but how lucky we are that we have these practices, these spiritual practices and spiritual principles to incorporate into our life during difficult times. You know, I know a lot of us over the last few years especially have experienced a lot of loss, a lot of grief. You know, and really we've had to, you know, put our third step into full gear, you know. Hey, I can say I'm turning it over, but, you know, to really do it on a daily basis was really a challenge, but one that obviously, was successful, and I learned so many valuable lessons on the other side now. You know, like, not only is everything going to be okay, everything is okay, you know. And when I continue to live in the present moment, all of my fears seem to be kept at bay. Isn't that amazing how that happens? You know, so anyway, just a couple of some of my meanderings before I get into my story. And I don't know about you, but for me, until the pain got strong enough, nothing was going to change. So I kind of stick to the script of what I'm supposed to do up here behind the podium, which is share my story. So I'm going to talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I like to live by the spiritual principles, and I really feel like one of the main ones is that when I give, I get back, you know. And so often this weekend, I know many of you here, and many of you have heard my story before, but I hope I can change it up a little bit. But also, things change, you know, in my life daily. So hopefully I'll be able to touch someone in a special way. And once again, I wanted to thank Ken for sharing something with me the other night that I really took straight to my heart, and it involved corrections, which has a really special place in my heart. But what Ken shared really, I'm going to take with me in a very special way this weekend, because what he said was what I shared with him made a difference, and I think it was it. When I spoke at this prepaid convention back in Callaway Gardens, I think it was like 10 or 11 years ago. And the fact that one little thing that I shared with him stuck with him really made me want to just keep on sharing my story, because you never know who it's going to help. So anyway, thank you, Ken. All right, so I am from the great state of New Jersey, in case anyone thought, you know, made the mistake that I'm actually really from Florida. I'm not. I think my accent is the dead giveaway. Big Irish Catholic family. My parents had 7 kids. My mom and dad are about to celebrate their 65th wedding anniversary. How blessed am I? You know, I know, it's amazing. And one of the reasons why I love hearing people's stories is because we hear the whole gamut, right? We hear people who sadly have had unfortunate childhoods, and then people who have had really happy childhoods, and I fall into that category. There's no reason why I should have gone down the path that I went down. But you know what? That doesn't even matter, right? But I always love hearing people's stories. I love hearing both the differences and the similarities, you know, because the bottom line is we all end up in here. And, spending too much time trying to figure it out is really just futile. So, but anyway, my mom was a stay-at-home mom. My dad, I always like to share a little bit about my dad, and I figured I'll share this story today. So my dad was favored to be the first ever to break the 4-minute mile in track and field. He ran for Villanova. He was one of their first great milers. And he missed it. Are you ready? He ran a 4.00.02. And he was supposed to be in the Helsinki Olympics, and he was favored to win the gold. And guess what? He tore his Achilles tendon at the Olympic trials, you know. So he always came so close. But one of the funniest stories that I like to retell Of course, it's family legend. But the New York Times does an article on the 10 best moments at Madison Square Garden every year. They do it once a year. And this race that included my father is in one of them. And so what it was a race for the world record. And so Madison Square Garden was full. I remember Joe DiMaggio was there that night. You know, the Shah of Iran, Rocky Graziano, they were all in the audience. And it was the big the competition was between me and my dad and this other guy. So anyway, they're on, and it was for the world record. So they're on the final straightaway, and when they went to do the curb, and the guy who was in the lead elbowed my father off the track. So he stepped off, so that's an automatic disqualification. So he got off the track, and he got back on the track. He ran after him. He grabbed him by the shorts, twirled him around, and they started fighting. And the guy who was in third went through and won and broke the world record. And the legend has it that my grandfather, who was a boxer from Brooklyn, basically, you know, the audience was just quiet. You could have heard a pin drop. And my grandfather shouts out, "Now take him back, take him out back, Freddie, and finish him off." But I share that because they were like, that's the blood that I come from. It's scrappy, you know, I mean, but I'll tell you something else. It's loyal. It fights for justice. My dad also, it says focus, discipline, hard work. You know, reach your goals. And he instilled that spirit into all of us kids. You know, so anyway, a little bit of that shares a little bit about how we were raised. We went to Catholic schools my whole life. I'm one of those Catholics that's really grateful for my Catholic education and upbringing. You know, I knew the difference between right and wrong. You know, the 12 steps really didn't teach me much in that arena. You know, I knew exactly what I was supposed to do, but so many of us, we took a detour and went down that road of self-destruction, you know, for many obvious reasons, some not so obvious, but nonetheless, we ended up here. Getting back to, the upbringing that I had, we all loved God. We all, you know, still do. As a matter of fact, my parents were a great example of people who prayed all the time, prayed before meals, etc. So you get the picture. Okay, so I'm going to jump right into my years of rebellion. It probably started when I was about 14 when I went to high school. And, right before high school is when I had my first drink, so I'll go ahead and share that. So my older cousin, who was 18, and a bunch of her girlfriends, we all went to the movies. And many of you know the symbolism behind this movie. It was the original Star Wars, right? So they went in with two bottles of rum, were dumping it in my Cokes, and I was just sitting in my seat just like, woo! Oh my gosh, this is so cool! You know, like flying around intergalactically with Han Solo, and you know, I mean, everything was larger than life. It took me out of this world, put me in this whole other plane on this new, like, galaxy, and I loved it. Oh, my gosh. And, you know, that's the deep imprint that drinking left in my brain. And I believe that it's like, the neurocircuitry of the brain is at the root of a lot of substance use disorders. So, and it's supposedly our first drinks are stored in that same area that trauma is stored. So I think that's really interesting because sometimes we don't understand really what's going on in our brain. But that first drink, I'll tell you something, I loved it. And that's how I went, that's what I did every time I drank. I went for that feeling. It was like plain Jane, gone. Enter extraordinary Jane, larger than life Jane. The Jane that when I walked into a room, people were like, oh yeah, the party's about to begin, you know? I mean, that's how I wanted to project my party lifestyle. So I got really sick, you know, and I share this because a lot of times people feel like they found their magic elixir and they sought to do it every day. Not me. I was so sick. I was like, oh my God, I'm never doing that again the next day, you know? And high school was just high school. I was the all-American kid. The only name I'm going to drop is one of my best friends in high school was Whitney Houston. And I share her name to honor her because, man, she should be sitting here today with all of us. And sadly, her life was just abbreviated because of the same thing that took us all down. You know, but she was amazing. I graduated in 1981. There were 81 girls in my class. That's it. So, and we're all still really close-knit and tight, and we're so grateful that we had our formative years together. And so anyway, my drinking really didn't take off until I went to college. And I must say I graduated kind of at the top of my class, and when I went to college, it was New York City in the 1980s. And I always like to sing my little line from the Eagles. You know, I was eager for action. Yeah, and then, you know, life in the fast lane. It was everything all the time. Life in the fast lane. And let me tell you, I was riding in that fast lane, baby. Oh, my gosh. And all of my dreams and aspirations went into the back seat of that car. You know, and I'll tell you something, you know, I know that we're not supposed to really, acknowledge, outside issues or have an opinion on them, but I have one. I freaking love them. I love snorting cocaine and I love smoking weed, but far and away drinking was my, you know, the love of my life. I never did any of that stuff without having, you know, drink. And I'm telling you, it was shots, it was straight up vodka, and it was tons of beer. And those other things, the outside issues really just helped me to drink longer and harder and faster, you know? So anyway, in New York City back in the 80s, it was the time of all the clubs. It was Studio 54, The Limelight, Peppermint Lounge, you know, Roseland. One of my claims to fame is I saw the Talking Heads and the Ramones at CBGB's, you know. I mean, I was out there. The kids today call it FOMO, fear of missing out. Well, yeah, that was me. I was out every night doing the deal, and oh, my gosh. And I had so much fun. You know, but again, my schooling certainly did go in the back seat. So I had my first geographic change when I was a junior in college, and I didn't even know it was a term, geographic change, but I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I need to get out of New York. My family was starting to, you know, just not invite me to family functions and stuff because I would always get drunk and act the fool. And I was like, oh, you know, they'll miss me when I'm gone. So I had the opportunity to go study in France. And I remember with such resolve, I said, I'm going to go over there. Nobody knows me. Clean slate. Start fresh. And I moved in with a French family, and they had a 19-year-old nanny living with them. And, man, we tore up that city of Nantes just like I was tearing up New York. It was crazy town. It was a great experience, and I had the opportunity to backpack through Europe that summer. I remember I had $300, 150 of it. We stopped off in Amsterdam to load up for our magical mystery tour. And the last $150, I got my hair done in London. You know, the rest of the month and a half was, you know, hey, take it as it comes, right? So, and then I went back senior year, and it was on. I started dating the biggest coke dealer on campus. So you get the drift, okay? So, then I was blessed with this kind of innocent face. I'm kind of looking around. Yeah, that's kind of innocent. And I could talk my way into or out of a brown paper bag, baby. I mean, oh, I was so cunning and manipulative. So I got a job right out of college teaching high school. And I moved to a city called Hoboken, New Jersey. And Hoboken is in the Guinness Book of World Records for having the most amount of bars in one square mile. So I was teaching high school by day and teaching in an Irish pub at night. And the days turned into nights, and the nights turned into days, and oh my gosh, I don't know how I did what I was doing. Well, I did, the chemical substances certainly helped out a lot. It was unbelievable. And this is, my Hoboken years is when I slowly but surely started to cross every line that I said I would never cross, especially with morals. You know, before it was always the party and the girls and going out and having fun. Then I started having a relationship with a married teacher that I worked with. I was like 22 and he was like 38. He was going through a major midlife crisis, you know. But of course I believed everything that he said and, you know, and I remember thinking, oh, you know, God understands where I'm at. God, you know, I would actually still go to Mass on Sunday. Actually, I remember one time I was with my married boyfriend drinking, doing coke, whatever, all night long. And I got in the car about 8 in the morning to go do the readings at 9 o'clock Mass in my hometown. And I was so wasted when I was doing the readings at Mass. I remember saying, my brothers never let me live it down. I said, this is a reading from St. Paul to the Filipinos. And, but you know, seriously, I thought God understood. Like, I remember thinking, God, I know you know I'm going through this right now. I know you understand. You know I'm a good person, you know. I mean, all weekend long we've heard people talk about delusion. You know, I was so delusional, I thought that was okay. Hey, at least I was going to Mass, right? You know, I mean, oh. So, okay. So, I lost both jobs that I had teaching high school. I had an opportunity to move far, far away. And again, I thought, oh, watch this. My family will really miss me this time because I'm not just moving to Europe. I moved to Japan. And I said, oh, Japan will be good for me. I heard if you get caught with a joint, you go to prison for like 7 years. So I'm not going near any of that stuff. Well, I got over there, and, I mean, it was on once again. I worked for, first of all, I hooked up with a bunch of crazy Australians and Brits and New Zealanders and Canadians and Irish and Scottish, and, I mean, we were all over there doing things that in our respective countries we would have gotten arrested weekly, you know, but instead the Japanese would just be like, oh, and they'd look down and they'd say, henna gaijin, which translates into crazy aliens. But we got away with it. I mean, I went for a year. I ended up living there for 3 years because it was so easy to live as a functioning alcoholic over there. And this is when I started to cross those lines again. So I worked for Time Life Educational Services because they really needed teachers of English over there. And I taught for mainly for Toyota. And I taught the managers who were about to be sent overseas after they took my class, which was 1 month long. We stayed in a training center, so I had to eat breakfast, lunch, dinner with these guys, and no Japanese. They had to speak English all the time. And every night we went out drinking, you know. And that's when I crossed the line of I needed a drink to get right first thing in the morning. I couldn't wait to get to my room to have a couple of drinks before a couple of shots, because I was very efficient, before the afternoon class. And then at 5 o'clock, it was on, you know. And I have to say, too, this is when my, you know, my other morals went by the wayside, too. I always chose drinking men, you know, and I would become incapable of acting like a woman with any kind of integrity or dignity. And I would have sad, semi-consensual experiences. You know what I'm talking about, don't you, ladies? And I would wake up in a haze filled with guilt and shame. And the only way that I could continue on was by picking up another drink, you know, and then it was all okay again. You know, it was the only thing that took away that discomfort, that guilt, that shame, and that became my cycle. So Japan was worth mentioning for so many reasons, but I feel like that's when I stepped into the true alcoholism. All right, so I could talk about Japan for the next, you know, hour, but I'm going to cut it short here. One of my best friends who's in London, I went to visit her a couple of years ago, and she took her journal out, and we just had a good time reading through it, but I'll never forget one of the passages said, my friend Jane decided to cut back on her drinking, which means she didn't drink for lunch on Thursday. So that kind of sums up my drinking, okay? All right, so anyway, I'm going to, again, fast forward. I get back to New York, a lot of disillusionment. Instead of my family being like, oh, she's back, they were like, oh, she's back, you know? And almost right out of the gate, I got my first DUI. And I was like, oh, well, you know, all the times I drank and drove, you know, I'll take one for the team. I pled guilty, and I got 6 months. I lost my license. And a friend of mine had a restaurant down in Florida. So this is how I ended up in Florida. And so I said, okay, that clean slate talk, self-talk again. All right, I'm going to move to Florida. Nobody knows me except for my friend. And I'm going to quit drinking, quit drugging, and straighten out my act, you know. And I moved, guess where? The Florida Keys. Now, that was a majorly failed experiment because the Florida Keys is where I hit that incomprehensible demoralization that our book talks about, you know. I hit the skids, man, down in the Keys. It was like, I remember, you know, I was couch surfing, right? We heard a lot of the speakers talk about doing that. I was couch surfing. I lost those jobs. I remember walking around with a bottle of Popov vodka at all times with bare feet, looking for, you know, where I was going to take a nap or whatever next. I went from, you know, I used to pride myself on snorting, you know, great cocaine. Well, this is when I started smoking crack. And I know I was on, I call them my fade to black months. You know, like, I didn't have the courage to kill myself, but I just wanted to go out. You know, I wanted to just blow up my heart or, you know, do a Leaving Las Vegas, you know, Nicolas Cage thing by drinking myself to death. Really, really dark, dark times. And then I had the proverbial look in the mirror and I saw like this skeleton. No joke, I had to be about 80, 85 pounds. And I had the wherewithal to call one of my cousins up in Fort Lauderdale. So I went up there, tried to get it together, met a guy, I was temping in Fort Lauderdale, and this guy, he was living in Europe at the time, and he was doing what they call ex-adventure tours, you know, like risk-taking tours. And by the way, at this, all of these times, I have to say that I had this major love of rock and roll. You know, I wanted to live that rock and roll lifestyle. I mean, if I had to explain myself in one sentence, it would be I was a risk-taking, rule-breaking, hell-raising, rock and roll, wanting to live that rock and roll lifestyle. And every short period that I would hit the skids, I would bounce back and I would be rock and roll all over again. You know? And so this was one of those times. And Max, his name was Max, he loved coming into town because he knew he was in for a great time, right? You know, so he was doing, you know, ex-adventure tours, as I said, for Delta Dream Vacation. So stuff like glacier climbing, rappelling mountains, cycling through Europe, you know, just, you know, the X was like for extreme adventure stuff. And he was right up my alley. And this one weekend he said, hey, why don't we go down to the Florida Keys? I'd really like to check out their water sports. And I was like, oh, God. Okay. You know, and off we went. And, the first tiki bar we hit, I remember going into, have a bunch of shots and, you know, we're dancing. And we did that every tiki bar all the way down to Marathon Key. And that night, I remember we wanted to go watch the sunset. So we went down this, like, bridge road, watched the sunset, went out drinking again, and I had this great idea, like, why don't we go back and watch the sun come up? So he was like, yeah. So we had a bag of weed, we had a case of beer, and I remember we saw this sign that said authorized vehicles only, right? And I was like, oh, well, vehicles, let's go. And down we went this bridge road. Now, the bridge was called the 7 Mile Bridge. I don't know if anyone knows that bridge, but they had just blown that bridge up for the movie True Lies with Arnold Schwarzenegger, unbeknownst to me. And you know, like when they blow the bridge up and there's like this big concrete thing in the middle. Well, you know, we're going down the bridge, and I remember I had just said to Max, I was like, I wonder where this bridge road is going to. It's like this road to nowhere. And all of a sudden, bam, I went crashing right into that concrete barrier. I had to be going at least 40 miles an hour, and I hit that thing head on. And I remember the first thing I did was, I mean, it was like, I never heard a sound like that, the crash and the crumple and the thunderous clap. And then I felt like this bolt of lightning. It was just sheer pain slicing right through my very core. And when I opened my eyes, the hood, there was fire coming out of the hood, smoke, and I was just like, oh my God, Max, we gotta get out of here. This thing's gonna blow. How are we gonna get out of here? And I remember, I put my, like, okay, so, I went to break because I saw at the very last minute, I saw that thing come up. And when I broke, my ankle just snapped all the way back. So I put my hand down to my ankle and I felt the bones in my ankle. And my hand was just dripping in blood. And then my knees hit the dash, so I completely smashed my pelvis. And my whole left side was just paralyzed because, unbeknownst to me, I broke my neck at C1, C2, which, by the way, is the same fracture that Christopher Reeves sustained. So a third of the people who get that fracture die instantly, a third are brain damaged, and a third are paralyzed. So when I say I'm a miracle, I am not kidding. I mean, literally, I defied the numbers in that arena. And anyway, so I just kept screaming, Max, Max, we got to get out of here. And he looked like he had just hit his head and that he was passed out. And I thought that for quite some time until when I was holding his hand, it actually went cold. And I finally, after some time, realized that he wasn't breathing and that he was dead. And when I tell you, I was screaming to God, pleading, take me too. There's no way I'll be able to live with myself. This precious life was no longer with us. I'm nothing but a damn drunk driver. This was a long time coming. You know, I felt like I was like this protected princess where stuff like this didn't happen. But I knew, you know, I knew I was going to face the major consequences if I lived. So I did not want to live. I remember taking, you know, just screaming like, Max, wake up, wake up, wake up. I couldn't believe it. Now I'm going to share this story because it really was life changing. So the police officer, I mean, I was literally on my last breaths when I saw the police come in the background. And at one of the court hearings, the police officer said, you know, I just got to share this with you, but I had a spiritual experience that night because I was just driving down the regular bridge road. It was almost as if some power tapped me on the shoulder, told me to back my car up and go down that old bridge road. And the power was so strong that when I saw the crash, I wasn't surprised, you know, and I'm telling you, he saved my life because I was definitely on my last breaths. And when he told me that at one of the court hearings, a wave of peace came over me, you know, for the first time in a very long time, because it meant like, you know, God left me here for a reason, like I shouldn't be here. So now the challenge is to figure out what that reason is, you know. Okay, so I'm going to fast forward because I hate talking about that part. I was in the hospital for, the accident was November 12th. I didn't get out of the hospital until Easter. And I had to learn how to do everything again. But I got let out on my own recognizance while I underwent intense physical therapy. And that's when I went to my first AA meetings. So the judge said that I could go to physical therapy or I could go to AA. That was the only time I could leave the house. So I went to a 7 a.m. AA meeting every morning. And I'm telling you, those people welcomed me with like the loving arms of my mother or my father, who, by the way, my mother and father bailed on me through this whole thing. They did the tough love thing. They were like, your friends have always meant so much to you. Let them take care of you. You're on your own. And I couldn't believe that, you know. But anyway, I remember you guys saying stuff like, you know, it's a really simple program. What you basically have to do is grow up, clean up, make up, and what's the other one? Oh, no, give up, grow up, make up, and clean up, right? So I was, or something like that. But anyway, I was like, that sounds pretty easy, you know, like, I think I can do that, you know, and then other simple things that were my buy-ins, like, Jane, this is the first step step one is the first step towards the solution. You know, Jane, you've got to abandon that fierce Irish pride that you have and start to seek humility. Or things like acceptance of step one. Your life is unmanageable and you're powerless over alcohol. No problem with that one. Acceptance of step one is profound. And there's great power in powerlessness, you know. Those were all the kind of things that you said to me. But the thing that stuck with me most about step one was honesty. I committed to living henceforth a life of rigorous honesty. I was never going to lie again. And I can tell you, maybe I'm delusional, but I don't think I have since then. And it's been, 26 years. So, yeah, right? I mean, I definitely committed to that. So I was not going to get up on the stand like my attorney wanted me to say and not guilty. It was like, oh, no, I'm guilty. I'm facing the music. I'm just going to plead guilty. So that's what I did, and I got a sentence of 5 years in prison followed by 10 years of probation. Now, prison, I am so grateful that I got sentenced to 5 years in prison because I had to go on this mining expedition to find out who I was without alcohol and drugs. I needed to stop rationalizing, drop the mask, break through those self-deceptions or those lies that I told myself time and time again, and just face the music, I experienced that powerlessness that I talked about. I was demeaned and degraded and debased on the daily in prison, and if any of you do prison work, like my friend Ken back there, thank you, because you made a big difference in my life. So I want to just give a round of applause to everyone who does corrections. But I learned that by simplifying my external life, I was able to hear the voice of God and really discover my true, authentic self. And strangely enough, in prison is where I felt the most free. So anyway, I learned a lot of things. I especially learned to be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, because that would diminish my usefulness to others. I really learned the true value of service work when I was in prison. I definitely feel like I was able to handle my two character defects, one of them being judgmental. I remember just a few weeks before the accident, I went on a date with some guy, and over dinner he shared that he did time in prison, and I was like, oh, I'm not going out with this guy again, And then the other one is resentments, my other character defect. I think that's just an Irish thing, I can hold a resentment. I was really resentful at my family, they really did the tough love thing. The whole time I was in prison, they must have had a family meeting. The whole time I was in prison, they did not send me a penny. Now, if you know what that's like when you're in prison, that's pretty humiliating. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I joke, I should have written Orange is the New Black, and the name of my book would have been I'm Nobody's Boo, because my ass is broke. But anyway, I really had to work on the resentments when I was in there, and I did, and I understand why my family did what they did. It was like that's the way they roll, the tough love thing. And let me tell you, when my father told me, he said, Janie, the best apology is changed behavior. We don't want to hear your words. We've heard those for, your whole life so far. So let's wait till you get out, see what you do. But if we ever find that you picked up a drink again, you can kiss your family goodbye. And he wasn't just talking. I knew that he meant it. People ask what was my biggest inspiration for staying sober. It was because I didn't want to lose my family. But I also wanted to honor the soul of Max, what a slap in the face to go through all this and then drink again, So anyway. All right. So in prison, I learned a lot of things, as I told you. But I really want to just talk quickly about a couple of steps that really made a difference in my life. First and foremost, my steps 4 and 5. So I wrote a really thorough step four. As a matter of fact, I remember saying to my sponsor, I want to do like an autobiography for him. So whoever I do step five with kind of has me in context, you know, instead of those lists, you know. But then, of course, I did the list the way the book suggests, too. And one Sunday at Mass, the priest said, ladies, I just want to let you know I'm an alcoholic in recovery, and I got permission to do fifth steps. And he was Irish from New Jersey. I was like, there's a sign from God. Sign me up. And I'll tell you, he was the perfect person to do that with. I'll never forget the first thing he said was, one of my favorite books is The Spirituality of Imperfection. And he said, and basically the theme of that book is, I'm not okay, you're not okay, and that's okay. You know? And he said, I really want to encourage you to be vulnerable. I've heard it all. I'm a priest, you know, but don't hold back. And he was amazing. I mean, he was able to, you know, point out my self-destructive patterns. I mean, you know, I remember him saying, yes, receive forgiveness, but give forgiveness too. You know, and that really meant a lot to me. But I feel like after doing my fifth step, all of my fears, my isolation, it all fell away. My fifth step is what marked my return to sanity. You know, it freed my mind, it freed my heart. He didn't judge me, rather he listened to me with such compassion. He cried with me when I cried. And so I felt this unconditional love like never before. And really, step five marked the relationship, the change in the race, all of my relationships, but especially my relationship with God. So anyway, and then I remember another priest at Mass said something that was very meaningful. He said, you know, Jane, you keep repeating the same sin when you come to confession month after month. He's like, you know, who do you think you are? Above accepting God's forgiveness? And that really was like, whoa. You know, I really let that sink in. And that's when I went about not only forgiving myself, but also, you know, moving towards redemption. That's what I knew I needed to work towards, was redeeming myself. So anyway, the other things that changed my mind was steps 8 and 9. There's such great wisdom in those two steps. Oh my gosh. I mean, you know, it is necessary to go back and rectify the wrongs that we've done. And when I did step 8 and I saw on paper the wreckage, oh my gosh, when I tell you I was that virtual riptide that tore through everyone in my life. But especially my family, they were the most affected. So I feel like once I became willing to clean my side of the street, put all that stuff on paper, and then my step 9 was also amazing. It continued to free my heart and my soul and my mind. And, you know, step 9, let's face it, man, you know, this is where we put the pedal to the metal. So I had the time to write a ton of letters. And with the discernment of my sponsor, I decided which ones to send and which ones not to send. And, you know, I did give a letter to Max's family at the sentencing, and I just told them, I know it might be too painful to stay in touch with me, but I'm willing to do that if you would like. And I want to dedicate the rest of my life to talking about drinking and driving, you know, the fatal combination. And they chose not to. They said it was too painful to hear from me ever. You know, I broke a lot of hearts. I broke a lot of trust. I broke a lot of promises. I broke a lot of laws, you know. And so anyway, but I feel like it was so important for you to make those amends so that we can change and live our best lives, you know. After my step 9 too, I committed to doing whatever I needed to do to achieve forgiveness and to build trust, you know. Let's talk about when I got out of prison. So the day I got out of prison, I started getting those God shots, those weird signs that so many of us have experienced. And it's like, man, that can't be a coincidence. That happened for a reason. So the first one was I had all of my earthly belongings in a hefty bag. And I got in the car, and I couldn't believe the song that was playing on the radio in the cab. I burst out in tears. The taxi driver was like, are you okay? I was like, I just got out of prison after 5 years. and they're playing this song, and he's like, what? And he turned it up, and we sang it together. I'm as free as a bird now. You know, I mean, what the heck, you know? I couldn't believe it. So, and as you know, that song is long, so I remember calling one of my brothers and, you know, look what song's playing. So, and then I went to my first AA meeting at 909 Central in Tallahassee. And guess who was at that meeting? The women that brought the AA meetings into prison. And I had no idea that that was the meeting that they went to. They were like, when did you get out? I was like, today! They're like, what? Oh my gosh, that's crazy! So I knew I was in the right place, you know? And all of these crazy things started happening. So I'm just gonna spend the last couple of minutes talking about some of the coincidences and the signs from God that I received. Anyway, I got 10 years of probation, as you know. I lost my license for life. I had to go to therapy once a month, and I had to do 2,000 community hours. So 2,000 community hours, by the way, is like a full-time job for a year. Can you imagine? But I had 10 years to accomplish all of that. My probation officer, when I went to, oh, and I had to go to an AA meeting every day. Can you imagine? For 10 years. Even my probation officer was like, I never heard of that before. I'm like, oh yeah. So anyway, I did that and I got connected and hooked up and I grew to love AA and I was just deep in it. I got a bike and I rode buses. It always would crack me up when people would be like, at meetings, I lost my license for 6 months. I'm like, yeah, I lost mine for life. Consider yourself lucky, you know? I mean, yeah. I got my first job. Wait, let me just back up and tell you a couple things too. I want to share about the judge that sentenced me. I got asked to speak at a gratitude dinner down in the Florida Keys a couple of years ago. And the host who picked me up at the airport worked for the court system, and she told the judge that sentenced me that I was speaking at the AA gratitude dinner. And so the judge went. And I was able to hug her, and she cried, and I cried, and I was just like, thank you for saving my life, you know. I was like, I'm telling you, I needed that 5 years because, you know, I just did. I needed to be segregated from society to work on myself. It was the best thing you could have done. The 10 years of probation I could have done without, but yeah. And she was crying too. She said, you know, so few times do I know what happens to people who I sentence. So I'm just, you know, so anyway, that was really cool. So I got a job and they told me I would never teach again. So I was like, oh well, I ended up in a work release in Tallahassee, Florida. Florida State University's there. Let me try and get into grad school. So, what better field than social work for love and service, right? So I got denied the first time. I got denied the second time because of my felony. Third time I got in. Third time was a charm. Not only did I get in, but I got a scholarship. And I'm telling you, there were angels always waiting to lift me up at every corner to give me a second chance. And I used to say that to people, like, where would anyone be without a second chance? Where would anyone be without forgiveness? Give me a chance. I won't let you down. So I didn't. So I graduated and my first job was working in a detox. How perfect is that, you know? And I slowly but surely was able to rebuild my relationship with my family. I'll tell you, I was really proud of the financial amends that I made too. I was making minimum wage and I paid off $15,000 in 5 years, you know, and while I was going to grad school. And my family, slowly but surely, rebuilt trust, and I am back way in their good graces again. And my parents are, one of the greatest gifts of sobriety is my parents are so proud of me, you know. So anyway, another thing that I wanted to share is I had to go to therapy once a month. Remember, I shared that. So right when I got out of prison, my therapist said, Jane, we got a carload of ladies. We're going up to this women's retreat or AA convention in St. Simons Island, Georgia, and you're coming. And I was just like, oh, boy, that sounds like fun. You know? But I went, and I'll never forget the magic that I felt being surrounded by all those women in recovery, you know? And one of the first speakers that I saw was this little woman with white curly hair, and she just talked about being, you know, a military mom, alcoholic, and her two sons, how she abused her two sons, and blah, 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 blah. And I remember thinking, wow, that takes a lot of courage to lay that out there like that. This woman's just like putting it, she's putting all her business out on Front Street. Wow, you know? Well, guess what? Today, that woman is my mother-in-law. How did that happen, right? And I think many of you might know I'm talking about the amazing Polly P. And, yeah, I don't know any woman who's done more in this program than she has, you know. I'm so proud to be her daughter-in-law. And, yeah, so moving right ahead, my life just started to unfold in beautiful ways. I remember, I got a call from the dean at the College of Social Work about 10 years ago and asked if I was interested in a full-time faculty position. Can you imagine? You know, they told me I would never teach again, but by doing the next right thing for 10 years, I built trust not only with my family, but with society and my employers too. And I was like, of course, you know, and again, what are the chances, right? They told me I would never teach again. Now I'm a professor at a major university, you know? It's unbelievable how that stuff happens. And I want to share this other really cool miracle. They also told me I would never drive again. Well, guess who drove to the convention this weekend? My mother ended up being like my biggest advocate after, you know, some time passed. Oh, I forgot. My husband always loves when I share this story, but, you know, talk about my parents went to a support group for parents of alcoholics. It was 12-step, but it wasn't Al-Anon. And my mother was hardcore. And I remember when I was in prison, you know, they told me this afterwards, that my sister told me, Mom was like, oh, you think we're going to send her money while she's in prison so she can drink Coca-Cola and eat potato chips? I don't think so. You know, so she was hardcore, and she was also like, you know, they told me at the meeting she would bang her fists, and, you know, and then she became my biggest advocate. She started writing to the governor of New Jersey, like, hey, my daughter has been doing the right thing. She got hit by a car. She got hit by another biker. She's been biking all over the place for, you know, 25 years, and, you know, I mean, you know, was she supposed to be riding her bike when she's 80, you know, and... So sure enough, after repeating over and over again, the letters that she wrote ended up in Governor Chris Christie's hands, and on his last night in office, he called me. Hello, Jane, this is Governor Chris Christie in New Jersey. I was like, what? And he said, listen, your mother is relentless. And, you know, and she sent folders about what you've been doing, and I just got to say, you make the great state of New Jersey proud. And I'm giving you a pardon for that first DUI that you got back in 1993. So that should open up for you to get a hardship license. And so I got a hardship license, and I've been good on that for several years, and it just got bumped up to what they call a business license, where I have permission to go to my AA things and to go to the grocery store and church and stuff like that. So they told me I would never drive again. Now I'm driving again. And the greatest miracle, oh, and I also was able to vote in the last election for the first time in 24 years. And the greatest miracle is that I met the one who I thought I would never meet. And at the 2009 Florida State Convention, this guy got up and shared his story. And I remember he talked about, like, Led Zeppelin and dropping out of school and moving to California. And he was totally rock and roll. And he had, you know, long hair and wore platform shoes and tight jeans. And I was like, we would have been dangerous together, you know. And I'll never forget when, after he told his story, I went up to hug him to say thank you, and the person in front of me moved aside. And when we were face to face, I was like, oh! Now, I've never lived with anyone, never cohabitated, never even dreamed of marrying anyone. And when I looked at him, I said, I'm going to be with this guy for the rest of my life. It was the weirdest thing, folks. I never felt anything like that before. And then I looked down and I saw a wedding ring on his finger. I was like, oh, man, I was wrong there. But, you know, I was speaking somewhere and Polly was there and somebody was like, Polly's really upset. Her son, oh, and we became Facebook friends, though. I'm in Tallahassee. He was in Chicago. We became Facebook friends, and so we kind of kept in touch. I saw what he was doing. He saw what I was doing. And Polly was all upset at this one convention. She was telling people that James was going through a really horrible, terrible, painful divorce. And I was like, oh, that's too bad. I knew it! And sure enough, he came and he visited his mom in Jacksonville, called to see if I wanted to have lunch, and lunch turned into dinner, and we've been together ever since. And we got married 6 years ago, and it was the wedding of my dreams, y'all. I mean, I got the white dress, the veil, my dad walked me down the aisle. I mean, it was just amazing. And a final miracle is I got a call at the beginning of the pandemic, and I still was kind of boinged up because I never received forgiveness from his family, right, Max's family. It just has eaten at me for like 25 years. And I remember my sponsor said, Jane, that's between you and your God and them and their God. Well, I get this email from somebody saying, Jane, are you the Jane that was in the accident with Max? If so, I was his roommate in college, and I'd really like to talk to you. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is like a long... So sure enough, I said, yeah, how about tonight? And he lived in California, so we he said, tonight would be great. He put his phone number, and he wrote, P.S., I'm a friend of Bill's. So anyway, I called him that night, and here, this is 25 years later. So you know what I mean? Like, it's never too late. We had the most healing conversation. He told me things that I needed to hear, and I was able to say to somebody with all the love in my heart, I am so sorry for what I did to take your boyfriend away from this, from our earthly life, you know? And he said, I forgive you, and it could have been any of us, you know? And it just was something, I don't know, and I felt, I'm teary-eyed because I can't believe the freedom that I felt after that phone call. You know, and anyway, it was a beautiful experience of once again saying it's never too late. You know, it's never too late for God to take action in your lives to make things better. You know, and it's also never too late for you to be the person that God really meant for you to be. You know, and I also want to say in closing, always, always remember that the higher power within you is greater than any fear before you. I don't know who to attribute that line to, but it's one of my favorites. Whenever I become, you know, obsessed with fear or paralyzed, I always remember, what are you worried about? God's got you in the palm of his hands. So thank you, everyone, and have a safe journey home.